welcome back to the program. Some of our soldiers have come back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, missing arms and legs. We've heard often about the phantom pain that often accompanies these losses, the feeling of pain in limbs that are no longer there. In many ways, the same is true for mental anguish. But the mind, too, feels pain. Where once normal life occupied a space, now for many who have long since left the war zone, the psychological pain is all-consuming and fills that once peaceful space. This is in part the story of our guest, Brian Kastner. Brian Kastner served 3 tours of duty in the Middle East, 2 of them in Iraq, as the head of the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit. He's written about his experiences returning home in his new book, The Long Walk Home, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. It is my pleasure to welcome Brian Kastner to the program today. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you here. First of all, explain what the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit did, and how did you wind up in it?
Well, EOD, which is what we normally call it, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, is a we're basically the bomb squad for the military. And so it's all 4 services. I was in the Air Force. But because we all go to the same school, we're all kind of interchangeable. And so I spent my time, despite being in the Air Force, assigned to the Army in Iraq, specifically in Balad and then Kirkuk in 2006. And there were never quite enough of us for all of the improvised explosive devices, the IEDs, all over the country. So, you know, we had the city of Kirkuk and a couple surrounding areas, and then there would be other EOD units in Baghdad and Mosul and all over. And you spend your days, trying to hopefully taking apart IEDs, taking apart car bombs, but far more likely you are often investigating the scene afterwards if they didn't get found in time for you to take them apart. I got into EOD by, I volunteered, and so does everybody else that's part of that. I wanted to do something that was really hard and was really challenging and that I could be proud of. And when I signed up in 2002, I mean, obviously nobody had any idea what was coming with the wars and how much the IED would be part of, like, really central to the war in a way that it hadn't in previous conflicts. We had IEDs had existed for a long time, but they've been pipe bombs in high schools in the United States. They've never really been fully realized the way they have the last decade of war.
Was there a certain type of person that wanted to do this job? As you looked at yourself and your colleagues that were doing this, was there something consistent among the men who wanted to take this on?
Well, it's men and women, and far more men than women, but there were always a few women in every unit. I think the stereotype of the mad bomber, that there was some Muppet character where he would just run around and blow things up. That's not necessarily it. It's not the guy who was constantly playing with fireworks in high school. I think that it attracts people who are smart, certainly. You have to have a certain amount of book smarts. But then also people who are mechanically inclined, the kid who wanted to take things apart but never necessarily put them back together. Like, you want to know how things work, but we're just a little bit rebellious and a little bit off, and were got in trouble in high school and maybe a little bit just because they were bored with their classes, and so we're looking for a bigger challenge. That's who it attracts. The people who stay in, though, the people who want to keep doing it, and this is the vast majority, I should say. It's not the adrenaline rush. It's not the how exciting it is. It's the brotherhood and the feeling of camaraderie. And when you do something that's that difficult with people in such close quarters, and you literally put your lives in each other's hands, you stay for the love of the guy or the man or woman next to you.
One of the things you talk about is that while we think of the job as taking apart these IEDs, that a great percentage of the job was really investigating after some of these things had blown up.
Right, and it's difficult to find an IED. If the bomber really wants to hide it, it's very hard to find. No matter the security or no matter all the different technology and systems that we have looking for them. Everything from dogs' noses to metal detectors and aircraft and all the various ways we try to find them. Unfortunately, at least when I was there in Iraq in 05, 06, 07, that time frame, far more went off and were detonated before we ever spotted them. And so then the idea is trying to gather the evidence, figuring out what it was and how it worked, and then hopefully collecting enough evidence that you eventually find the guy, the cell who put it out. Or if not even put it out necessarily, but designed it to begin with. You're trying to find just the very few people with the know-how that were able to make these devices.
And one of the other aspects of it is that when you go into these places after these bombs have exploded, you talk about the social justice part of the job, that you and your men are there to fix everything, to make things right where something like this has happened.
Yeah, the social justice part of it was important to me. I went to Marquette University in Milwaukee, which is a Jesuit school, and I think some of that Jesuit social justice rubbed off on me. And the idea that we didn't discriminate on which bombs we tried to take apart or which ones we investigated. We tried to take them all apart. If it was targeting a school or a U.S. convoy, it didn't matter. And if we investigated all of them as well, and you hoped that every day Iraq was a little bit safer from what you were doing. Unfortunately, it didn't always feel that way. It often felt that no matter what you did, you were just swimming through the mud, and you were never making progress. But you hoped that a little bit here and a little bit there, at least this one bomb didn't go off. And, at least we all made it through the day. And that was that you kind of had to live day by day like that.
And there was the stress that came from seeing the damage and the carnage from those bombs that went off. There was the stress from deactivating bombs where possible, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But there was also, as somebody that was sending men to do this job, there was also the additional stress that you had from sending your colleagues out into very dangerous situations.
Yeah, EOD guys, we tend to all be the guy on the football team who wants the football at the end of the game, for the big win. Like, it's not, you tend not to be a shrinking violet or a wallflower or something. So it is definitely more dangerous to be the person putting on the bomb suit and going down to take apart the device. But in some ways, giving up that control, you'd rather be the person doing it, keep your brothers safe, you do it so they don't have to. And that's where the title of the book comes from, The Long Walk, is this idea that somebody has to put on the bomb suit and take that long, lonely walk. And I never did it in combat. I did it in training, and that was stressful enough, but it's just watching somebody walk down to the device if they absolutely have to, which you didn't do unless you absolutely have to. But when the moment of truth came, you're giving up that control, and you just hold your breath, and your heart doesn't start beating again until they get back.
And the long walk home also talks about the experience that you had once you came home from the war. Talk a little bit about that. And everything, as you write about it, seemed very normal when you first got back. It took a while for things to change.
It did. And I came back and I thought I was fine. I should maybe put fine in finger quotes. I'm not really sure I had a good idea what that meant. But it took a couple years before all of these non-specific feelings kind of rushed in at once. And this may sound odd, considering everything we've just been talking about, but I didn't realize that the war was the problem right away. Like I said, I got home and I was fine. Why should it take a couple years for it to all creep back in? But there was all these non-specific symptoms, the eye twitches and the feeling in the chest and the gurgling and this pain in my arm. And I thought maybe I had a heart attack or maybe I had, I didn't know what, but it all came rushing in at once. I call it the day I went crazy, and in the book I use crazy mm-hmm. with a capital C because no other word seemed to quite fit. It I didn't have one word that described it all, and so I made up my own. I feel like it all happened on one day. My wife has told me later that she it seemed to her like my gas tank or the gauge on my gas tank was going down slowly, and I just noticed the light going on. But she had kind of noticed this decline over years.
And in fact, you went to the emergency room a couple of times thinking you had a heart attack.
I did. I mean, what else do you call it when you have that pain in your left arm and this pain in your chest? And that's the only reason that I eventually made it to the right mental health floor. I didn't know what to call it, and to me it was a very physical thing, and I hadn't quite connected the emotional parts of it, I guess. And it was only because I was a problem child in the emergency room, and I went back a couple times, and they said, okay, well, so it's not your heart, so we need to figure out what this is. And after they ran all the tests and stress tests and everything else in my heart, and it was nothing, I eventually made it to the mental health floor because it was just one more doctor's appointment. What do? If you have a doctor's appointment, you go, and they made it for me.
And it's interesting that you, like so many others of the public, had this stereotypical image of what a crazy vet coming back might be like, and you were sure you certainly didn't fit that image.
Oh, absolutely. Nobody wants to be the crazy vet. I mean, especially veterans. You see this, it's that crazy uncle that hides under the kitchen table when a car door slams. You don't want to be, that person. And since that's not what was happening to me, I had stopped jumping at loud noises a long time ago, and I didn't have one incident that was playing over and over again in my mind. I didn't seem to fit some classic case, and so why should the war be the problem? And I guess war was only part of the problem. It's partly, I discovered that the crazy feeling was partly anxiety, but not just that, and partly grief of friends that had died, but not just that, and maybe a little bit of existential panic, and maybe a little bit of this, and maybe a little bit of that, but it was all, I don't know, it was the buildup of all of those things. And I still have trouble describing what it was. It took me a whole book to try to describe what it was.
And part of what it also was is the realization that you had changed, that the war had made you do things and put you in situations that heretofore had been unimaginable, and as a result, you had changed in ways that really weren't clear to you.
That's right. And I, it took my wife to kind of explain, the person that I had been before, or the things that she noticed that I had stopped doing. And I think there is a little bit of mourning for the person that you aren't anymore. And I think that just culturally, we have this idea that you're going to send a person to war, and when they come back, the problem that they're going to have is education or employment or something. But we don't always plan on the person being that different, just being a different person that comes home. And why shouldn't they be after just the extremity of the extreme nature of the things that you experience in a war and the things that you learn about yourself? I thought I was going to be the kind of person, or I thought that I was the kind of person that I don't know, wouldn't be able to do all of the things that I had done. And I don't mean, I just mean the I don't know, how cheap human life is, and how you see that in a war, and that you'll do anything to survive, and you'll do anything to keep your friends alive, and just watching what human beings are capable of doing to each other, how can you not be changed after that?
It also had a very real impact just in your day-to-day life when you were home. You talk about hearing the kids' school bus or your kids suiting up for a hockey game.
Right, and to go back to that veteran stereotype, like I said, I thought it was all going to be, you can't watch war movies and you can't listen to fireworks or something. But for me, the parts that brought back the war, even if I would try to put the war out of my head, I would just think about it all day long. And why is that? It's because, like you say, the school bus, that diesel engine has the same distinctive rattle that a Humvee engine does. And when I was putting my son in his goalie equipment in hockey, you put on a bomb suit the same way on another person, and in fact, you do everything in the same order. You start with the legs, then you move up to the chest, and you put the helmet on last. And I, even if I wanted to just move on, whatever that means, from the war, I couldn't when I had all these reminders.
There was also, coming back to what you were talking about before and what you saw there and how it changed you, the sense of morality, your whole sense of moral underpinning had changed, and you began to realize that.
Yes, I think that the I think again that I grew up learning that you had a conscience, and a conscience keeps people from doing bad things, and so then it's only bad people that do bad things. But I saw lots of perfectly normal people doing awful things to each other. And because they're just trying to survive every day. And so, I guess not to get too metaphysical about it, but at a certain point I stopped seeing good and evil, that there was just human beings are really capable of really doing awful things. There's, which is the Russian philosopher that said, if we could only just separate the good people from the bad people, it would be easy, but the line of good and evil runs through the human heart, and we're all capable of it. And you really start to see that you're not above that, that actually you're mired in it. You're part of that that's as capable of these things as anyone else.
One of the things you discovered was that it wasn't just PTSD, it wasn't just the psychological aspect, but there was an element of traumatic brain injury as a result of the work that you had been doing.
Right, and I think that's an important part of it, at least for me, and I should say that there's plenty of neuroscientists and psychologists that will tell you that where PTSD stops and TBI begins is not necessarily clear, because in some ways it all involves brain chemistry and TBI, especially from the brain damage. But there's just been so much research in the last decade about this, in the last two decades, that, you know, when you blow something up over and over and over again, the blast wave itself is going to do damage to your head. And it's not a concussion. A concussion is when your brain smushes against the inside of your skull and bleeds, and there's some damage there. But your head doesn't have to move. You can just simply experience the blast wave, and as it runs through your head, there's going to be lots of damage internally, as each little neuron can rip and tear. And what the damage is completely random and capricious, and it's everybody loses something different, and you can have one awful event, one truly traumatic event, and people that experience that have to learn to walk again, and they have to learn to use their limbs and everything. But if you're a bomb technician and you blow something up every day, it's more like an occupational exposure. It's like smoking or playing in a band and having the music up too loud. You just do a little bit more damage all the time, and some people lose, the ability to do high school algebra, and I lost memories of my kids. My short-term memory is fine, but my long-term, I just have holes, and it's really frustrating because it affects everybody differently, and then you don't know if the problem is emotional, or you don't know if the problem is some physical, and that your brain is just exhausted trying to fix itself.
And the answer is both, yes?
It is, and the answer is different for everybody. And so I did go through rounds of testing, and like I said, my short-term memory is fine, but there's no test for long-term memories. So why don't I remember my kids being born, and why do I remember the day of six V-beds, I call it, is what we started calling it. A V-bed is a vehicle-borne IED. I remember that day with the six car bombs perfectly. Don't remember my kids being born. And so there's two levels there. There's what's the physical damage to your head, and then there's, like you mentioned before, dealing with being a new person, dealing with the person that's lost those memories. It's how you react to your own brain.
How did the process of writing this book and reliving much of this, how did that impact you?
Well, in some ways it didn't, because like I said, every school bus and hockey game was reminding me. So I wasn't reliving it more than I was. So writing it, the initial writing it wasn't worse or something. It wasn't, it wasn't more traumatic. What I've discovered, though, in writing it and as time passes from the writing, that what it's really done is given me space to forget. That if I don't have to keep all of these memories of the day of six V-beds in the front of my head anymore. If I want to know what happened to me, I can just go and read. I can read my own book, and I don't have to. I don't have any obligation to hold on to that anymore. And so there's a lot of writing programs for veterans, and it's not about writing a book to publish. It's about just getting your story out and sharing it and getting it off your chest, so to speak. And then once it's out there, you know, you can put it in a drawer and forget about it.
As you talk to other colleagues that came back that were doing similar kinds of work, to what extent were their experiences upon returning home similar to yours?
Well, we would commiserate a little bit, and I don't want to speak for any particular veteran. The funny thing about the wars, about every war, I think, is every veteran fights their own war. Everybody sees something different. Everybody has a different job, and so, you know, everybody has their own experience, and coming home is different. But talking to other bomb technicians and the Brotherhood, you know, at first we could commiserate because we often felt the same, or we were having the same problems, but that doesn't mean we know how to fix it. And we tend to be fairly type A personalities, so if you can't, what's the point in identifying a problem if there isn't some solution? If you find the bomb, you want to take it apart immediately and reduce the hazard, so to speak. So I think, you know, some guys have tried different things, and I have some friends on medication, and that doesn't always, most people don't have a very good experience there, but through some combination of running and exercise and talking and commiserating, you hope that everybody finds some peace somehow. You don't have to have, you know, not every veteran is crazy, and not every veteran has something that needs to be diagnosed. Like I said before, sometimes you're just a different person and you need to come to terms with that, but that doesn't mean you have some condition that, like I said, that requires a diagnosis.
Brian Kastner, his book is The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. It is just out in paperback from Anchor Books. Brian, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. It was my honor.
Thank you.